Listeners like you make living on Earth possible each week. Please contribute today by clicking on the donate link to the left of the page. And thanks.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Jeff Young, and we're looking ahead to the coming decade. Hundreds of native languages are expected to die by 2020, unless David Harrison of the Living Tongues Institute has his way.
I feel a great sense of responsibility when I'm sitting at the foot of an elder. I want to hear every single word that they are prepared to share with me, and I want to listen very attentively, to record it, to understand it. And often, even the people in their own household or their neighbors don't recognize or even know that they happen to know this ancestral language. So what you get is a few elderly speakers scattered across different locations. I'm able to create new situations for them. I actually transport elders from one village to the other, and they just love it. They just start talking. They even forget that I'm there, that I've got a camera and a recording device. For example, our last speakers of Chulim in Siberia, and the Chulim language is highly likely to go extinct within the coming decade. I can play a little sound clip for you of some conversation in Chulim among some of the very last elders. One of the projects that I've been working on with the Living Tongues Institute is to help some of these small languages cross the digital divide and to bring them over into high-tech domains so that the members of the community can say, oh, well, of course my language is suitable for text messaging or can be posted on a social networking site. It's just as good as any other language. I can use it in all these domains. And I've created a suite of talking dictionaries for some small and not very well represented languages. I'm right now in the process of turning the talking dictionary into an iPhone application, so you would actually be able to have your iPhone and to download and play and listen to sound files from very small languages that are maybe endangered or may not be very well represented in cyberspace yet, but they will be. And this is really the key. And these languages, once they have that opportunity, once the door is open to them to enter into high-tech domains, of course they will adapt. They will develop all of the little shortcuts that we have in English, the sort of LOL text messaging abbreviations and things. They will adapt perfectly because adapting to new circumstances is really what languages do best. It's not an inevitability. Small languages do not have to be extinct. They don't have to be oppressed out of existence. There's room in the world. There's room in the human intellect for a diversity of languages.
Living Tongues Institute Director David Harrison. Well, technology will continue to shape our tongue in the coming decade, too, bringing radical change to that ultimate arbiter of the English language, the dictionary. Lexicographer Erin McKean once edited the new Oxford American Dictionary. Well, now she's working to close the book on dictionaries as we know them.
Oh, totally. But I think that the book shape is the wrong shape for the dictionary. I don't know if you cook very much. And if you're from the South, you may have actually cooked with Crisco. But at some point in the recent past, you started being able to get Crisco in sticks. I think that Crisco in a stick is one of the triumphs of modern civilization because it's so much easier to cook with. So the tub is the wrong shape for Crisco because you get it all over your hands. It's really hard to measure.
That's true.
In the same way, the book is the wrong shape for the dictionary because it's too small. It can't hold all the words. It can't even hold all the right kinds of information about the words that it does hold. It doesn't tell you anything about people's opinions about a word. It doesn't tell you people think this word is beautiful. It doesn't tell you, oh, this adjective is only used with these objects. It doesn't tell you how words work. It only tells you what words mean. And what words mean is just one facet of how words work.
So the way we use a dictionary is clearly going to change. Is the content of the dictionary going to change a lot as well? What's going to get in?
Every single word or phrase or idiom or combination. The only reason that some things are in a dictionary right now and some things aren't is that the print book is just too small to hold every word of English. Even the Oxford English Dictionary has fewer than 1 million words in it. And it's pretty easy, without even doing a whole lot of heavy lifting, to find more than, say, 4 million unique English words.
You gotta draw the line somewhere. If I just say squizzlebop, is that gonna be a word?
If you use it as a word, it's a word. It's all about intent and communicative value.
This is anarchy. This is anarchy.
No, it's not. Just because a word is a word doesn't mean it's a good word. And so part of the job of the dictionary is to let you know most people think this word is terrible, so maybe you don't want to use it. A lot of people feel that if a word's in the dictionary, it's perfectly okay to use, and if it's not in the dictionary, it's perfectly not okay to use it. And this is not a very good system for making word decisions, because the dictionary is on a time lag, especially print dictionaries. And because there may be words that are perfectly, let's say, cromulent in certain contexts that are not okay in other contexts.
Cromulent? Excuse me, I have to go to a dictionary.
Now, that's a word you may not find in a dictionary because it's from an episode of The Simpsons. And cromulent means okay, and it was actually used when one of the teachers in Bart's school was saying to another teacher, you know, I can't believe you don't know that word. It's a perfectly cromulent word. But once it was used in The Simpsons, it became a word automatically.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Will emoticons ever make it into the dictionary? Please say no.
I'm going to have to disappoint you.
Oh.
Well, okay, but think about this. The exclamation point, if you really think about it, is a kind of emoticon. It's an image that tells you what kind of expression goes with a sentence. I mean, think of the difference between saying it's on fire, period, and it's on fire, exclamation point.
Is there any place at which I can make you draw the line and say, nope, sorry, that's just not acceptable, that's not a word?
People have tried. But the truth is that I'm not the person who decides what's a word and what's not a word. If you use something as a word, there's a little magic and alchemy that happens that makes that a word.
But you're writing dictionaries. Isn't that your job?
My job is to map the language. So I tell you where everything is and what it is, but I don't leave the red light district off the map because I disapprove of it.
Uh-huh.
That would make a pretty bad map. And then you'd stumble into the red light district and not know where the heck you were. And that wouldn't help anybody.
Are we headed towards something better than a word?
In my opinion, there is nothing better than words. Even if they invented some magical telepathy device or something that let us convey emotion through perfume or anything else, nothing is better than words. And that is possibly my not inconsiderable bias talking.
Erin McKean, lexicographer and now CEO of a new online dictionary called Wordnik. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
And now, from living languages of the coming decade to living buildings.
I'm Rachel Armstrong. I advise architects on how to incorporate biological systems into their design work. My work at the moment involves a system called the protocell. Protocells are self-assembling, autonomous, very primitive chemical systems that have some of the properties of living systems, but are not, strictly speaking, alive. They are capable of lifelike processes such as growth, movement, sensitivity, and I think these protocells are going to be incredibly important for us in the next 10 years or so, in that we will develop materials that we can put on the outside of buildings that can take carbon dioxide from our carbon-rich air that we produce in the cities and around our homes and factories, and they will trap the carbon dioxide and fix it as a solid material on the outside of the buildings. And we will see our buildings transformed by these materials that are carbon fixing. This is going to give quite interesting appearance, you know, to a community of houses. So down your street now, all the buildings have got this bio-lime, let's call it, on the outside of the buildings, and they're gradually growing, and you can see little stalactites and stalagmites, so little spicules of limestone that has manage to stray away from the outside of your home. And maybe there's a source of carbon emissions. Maybe somebody's got a dirty chimney down the road. And the biolime will actually start making its way towards that source of nutrients, because it would regard carbon emissions as being something that it would like to engage with and turn it into a crystal. And so you could start to imagine two buildings would snuggle up together and they will lose the space between them. It'll be a bit like cloud watching, where we will start to see different characters in different houses. So maybe some houses will look like a giant goblin. Others would look more like a sleeping cat. So these technologies will be quite visible. And there's a real reason for this. And I think this is an important reason, that at the moment, it's very hard to get any kind of handle on how we are affecting our environment by the production of carbon emissions. We can't see carbon dioxide. But when we actually are able to see it in a material way, growing on the outside of our houses, we can actually start to have a personal relationship with carbon dioxide levels. We can see that, you know, maybe one year the growth of the houses is much thicker than another year, a bit like the rings on the bark of a tree. The protocells will become more autonomous as we develop the science that's underpinning them. It's predicted that in the next 10 years that protocells may actually be able to self-regulate and divide. The way I think that these completely challenge our understanding of technology is that at the moment we consider technologies to be things that we can control at the push of a button. I think the 21st century is going to give rise to technologies that we don't control by subordination, by annihilation through antibiotics and antiseptics. What we need to do in order to get the best out of these technologies is to become engaged with them, so that we interact with them, we monitor them, and we live with them. We live alongside them, just like all the other species on the planet. We blossom when we're in complex ecologies, and I think that synthetic ecologies and synthetic organisms are going to be an important part of that integrated balance that we should attain if we are able to behave in a more responsible and grown-up manner towards all living forms on the planet.
Architectural advisor Rachel Armstrong. Well, we've heard a lot about problems we'll face on our planet in the coming decade, many of them of our own making. But astronomer Neil deGrasse Tyson says we'll also need to keep an eye on the sky. Tyson directs the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, where, among other things, he keeps watch on an asteroid called Apophis.
You know, the solar system is a shooting gallery, and Earth, many people don't know, plows through several hundred tons of meteors a day. So the range of these that could hit us is huge. Apophis, that was discovered in December 2004. It's an asteroid about the size of the Rose Bowl. If the Rose Bowl, imagine that as a kind of like an egg cup and you place something in it to hold it. That's about how big that asteroid is. That's not too shabby. That one, you know, if it hits, it'll do some serious damage.
And it's going to strike the Earth in 6 days.
The first calculation showed that there was a real chance it could hit Earth in the year 2029, on April 13th, which, by the way, happens to be a Friday. No one read about this because, coincidentally, over that same week, we had the tsunami in Indonesia. And so that rightly got the headlines, given the death toll that that exacted. What's intriguing, however, is that if this thing hits Earth, the current trajectories show that it would hit the Pacific, if it hits the Earth at all. And that would create a tsunami on the West Coast that would dwarf anything that happened in Indonesia. After better orbit was calculated, because once you discover something, you have a few data points, and there's huge uncertainties if you only have a few observations. As the months went by, we had better orbital data, and we determined that, no, it will not hit us April 13th, 2029, but it'll come very close. It'll come closer than Earth's orbiting communication satellites. It'll be the biggest, closest thing we've ever seen in the history of history. It'd be visible from Northern Europe, and it's basically, think of it as a shot across our bow. The universe saying, you know, I'll miss you this time, but I'll give you another chance to try to deflect me. Depending on its actual trajectory on that pass, we will learn whether it will hit us April 13th, 2036. We're on a 7-year intersection orbit. Our orbit plus the orbit of that one intersects every 7 years. Currently, the best estimate is several in a million that it will hit us. And you say, oh, let's not worry. Well, if it hits us, it could do $1 trillion worth of damage. And so several in a million, you get some insurance people. They can calculate how much, what kind of insurance you'd want to take out given what kind of risk that represents. And it means you should be doing something.
But how can the entire world prepare for the ultimate disaster?
Oh, so you want to protect the Earth, and you realize, in fact, everybody has to agree to do this. And yes, that's a whole other level of international cooperation. So if an asteroid is going to come and render Earth extinct, then petty differences among people chosen for completely arbitrary reasons of what god you worship or what skin color you are or what line in the sand separates your property, that all that pales compared to the prospect of going extinct. So yes, we would need international cooperation. What many people, we have top sort of engineers and dynamicists working on, one problem which is involves a, what we call a gravitational tractor, a kind of a tractor beam where you send up a spaceship, bring it close to the asteroid but not touch it, and you sort of park it there. And what I mean by it, these both are moving through space. When I say park, I mean you match velocities with the asteroid. And their mutual gravity will want to attract them to each other. And as they drift, you say, no, I'm not going to let that happen. So you put on little retro rockets on the rocket to prevent them from colliding. The act of doing that effectively tugs the asteroid out of harm's way. Because all you really want to do is move it so that it will not hit Earth in its trajectory. It'll still be out there. Its orbit will still cross the orbit of the Earth, but you've lived to enjoy another day. That's really the way to do it. So it's a matter of how much do you want to protect the Earth. It's really what it comes down to.
Astronomer Neil deGrasse Tyson directs the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. You can hear more from him and many of the other big thinkers in today's show and take a trip through the past decade with an interactive timeline. It's all at our website, loe.org. Living on Earth is produced by the World Media Foundation. Our crew includes Bobby Baskin, Eileen Balinski, Bruce Gellerman, Ingrid Lobet, Helen Palmer, Jessica Elise Smith, Ike Shrieskanjaraja, and Mitra Taj, with help from Sarah Calkins, Marilyn Gavoni, and Sammy Sousa. Well, today we bid a sad and very grateful farewell to our interns, Quincy Campbell and Nirja Parekh. Technical help this week from Dana Chisholm. Jeff Turton is our technical director. Allison Lierish-Dean composed our themes. Steve Kerwood is our executive producer. You can find us anytime at loe.org. I'm Jeff Young. Thanks for listening.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from the National Science Foundation, supporting coverage of emerging science, and Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt and smoothies. Stonyfield pays its farmers not to use artificial growth hormones on their cows. Details at stonyfield.com. Support also comes from you, our listeners, the Ford Foundation, the Town Creek Foundation, and the Oak Foundation, supporting coverage of climate change and marine issues, and Pax World Mutual Funds, socially and environmentally sustainable investing, Pax World for tomorrow, on the web at paxworld.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.